all of that information needs to be made available for these prospective buyers to digest. And the more that can be made available, and the more that that's organized into different buckets of legal, employee, insurance, benefits, blah, 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 the better. It's going to save the company a lot of time from serving requests versus being proactive by getting that stuff out there. And you don't really have anything to fear. All the buyers be under a non-disclosure agreement. And that's just a very kind of well-oiled machine around making that information available to get your last few buyers down to the one you would like to choose and have them under a letter of intent.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Back in 2013, Mark, I closed, 23 transactions. It was a busy year for me. Do you have any idea what the average transaction size was?
Why don't I guess? Well, it's you. It's you. So I'm going to say like $7 million.
I love putting you on the spot because you do it to me all the time. The average transaction size.
Your guess would be like 250.
It was 125.
Holy cow.
125, very small. And at that time, there were no private equity firms poking around the e-commerce space for these smaller listings. Today, it's a completely different story. I think my average transaction size was 10 times that last year. And a lot of buyers or a lot of sellers, the question I get asked all the time are, who are your buyers? And it's a mix of everyone, but more often than not, now we're seeing private equity firms come into this space. And I understand you had an expert in that area on the podcast.
Yeah, private equity is a topic that's coming up more and more frequently with sellers, especially on the higher end of that revenue spectrum that we really work with. And it makes sense because once you get to a certain size of business, your buyer is more likely than not going to be at least somewhat in the private equity place area of the buyer pool. In addition, you know, we've talked before. I had Ryan Tansom on. We talked about selling to a strategic buyer versus a marketplace buyer. And obviously, people always look at this, especially at the higher ends, and say, well, I kind of want to have a strategic buyer. Well, one thing to keep in mind here is that this is kind of a spectrum, right? It's not binary. You're either strategic or marketplace. But when you get into that private equity world, private equity is almost always going to be something of a strategic play. So I thought, look, this private equity world is something that people keep asking about. Let's actually start to dissect it a little bit. So Brian and I talked, and we spent probably about half of this interview just kind of going over what is private equity, how does it work, you know, what is the definition of this, and what are the sizes of it, and really just trying to ask some of those silly questions that maybe, you know, you kind of wonder about but don't want to ask because you don't want to sound like you don't know what you're talking about. And so we went over a bunch of those questions, but then we also went over what does their process look like, what does it look like to sell with to a private equity firm, what are the drawbacks to it, and what are the benefits of it as well. And really, this is kind of a general education podcast. But I think also, and maybe more importantly, for those of you out there who are thinking about selling down the road and you're looking and trying to peg the different values that you want to get from an exit, and maybe you think, well, I want a $10 million exit or a $15 million exit. If you get to that point, what's it going to look like to sell to a private equity, and what do you need to do to really make yourself appealing for a private equity firm? And how does the deal change when you're selling to private equity as well? So we really cover a lot of ground in about 30 minutes. Brian is super knowledgeable. Obviously, he works in this space. And I really appreciated him coming on the podcast because, again, just downloaded a ton of information.
Well, let's get right to it.
All right, Brian, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, no, it's great to be here. Thanks for hosting.
All right. So I don't expect people to listen, you know, my guests have listened to the podcast in advance. And I don't know if Joe's been doing this. He records like, I don't know, 9 out of 10 episodes. And I don't know if he's continued on the tradition, but we like to have our guests introduce themselves. Because you know your story better than I know your story, and figure it's a little bit easier. So why don't you give just kind of the quick 30-second to 1-minute rundown on who you are?
Yeah, I'm Brian Rassel. I'm a vice president with Huron Capital Partners, which is a middle market private equity firm based out of Detroit, Michigan. The firm is 20 years old and has invested in, we're typically control buyout investors, where we'll buy a majority of a business and have done that through five successive funds starting back in 1999. And the kind of industries that we play in are business services, consumer, and specialty manufacturing. You know, kind of the interest in how I got to know you, Mark, for those listening, is that, believe it or not, all of those spaces are being affected by e-commerce or different kind of SaaS business models that are internet-based. And taking it upon myself to maybe be the person at the firm who is trying to understand those influences on all of our companies and make sure that we're in a position to incorporate those changes that are going on out in the economy at large and being done by a lot of people who probably listen to your podcast, and make sure that we're bringing those forces to bear in the businesses we own so that they can be successful today and well into the 21st century. So,
all right. Well, I got a lot of questions for you, because this world of private equity is encroaching or coming into the internet business acquisition world more and more. And whether it's because at QuietLight our deal value is moving up, or private equity is starting to look at different price ranges and maybe this convergence of these worlds, and also private equity looking more in the online space, it's just becoming an increasing topic that we're seeing more and more of. And we're also seeing individuals that have started up on their own raising funds to do larger acquisitions or to string acquisitions together. Sure. So what I'd like to do, and I already kind of told you this in our conversation before I hit record, I'd like to go over some of the basics here of the private equity world and how it looks in the internet space as well. And then learn a little bit more about your fund and some of the things that you guys are doing over there and all that. So quick shout out to Chris from Centurica and Rhodium. I know that we talk about him so much that it's almost as if he's a sponsor. He's not, but this is again how we got introduced. You spoke at Rhodium, and then you and I had a chance to speak after that, and good conversation. So thanks, Chris, for the introduction. Again, so let's start out really, really basic here. How would you define private equity?
Private equity is capital, private capital being put to work in private businesses. And so I like to make, you know, for folks who really don't know much about it, a little quick stat just kind of on the U.S. economy. There's half as many publicly listed companies as there were in 1996 or 1994, something like that. So even though the value of the public markets is larger, the amount of places you can park that capital in the public markets is smaller, the total number of listed names. Private equity is a big part of either big institutionally managed money, whether that's from insurance companies, endowments, pension funds, universities, those kind of things. This is their way to go participate in the portions of the economy that are still private companies that they can't get access to otherwise, unless folks like me help them get access to it. It also includes folks that, and I can kind of go into different flavors of private equity, but depending on the size, from the Bain Capitals of the world down to very, very small funds that are more entrepreneurial, there's sort of every flavor under the sun, and certain family offices and other things like that. But that would be private equity, pooled private capital going into private businesses.
Now, how do these funds start up traditionally? And I imagine that there's a lot of ways that they can start up. You've listed a number of sources of money, and I think sometimes we forget just how much money there is in some of these places, such as the university endowments.
For sure. I mean, there's an unbelievable amount. I'm going to get this off. I'll be wrong by $100 billion, but I think something like $600 billion flowed into private equity funds last year. So these, and the source of a fund, or the way a fund works, is that a fund manager, like the folks I work for here, or I'm a part of, they go out and they make their pitch about how talented their professionals are and what their track record is and the fact that they can get access to great deal flow and great opportunities, places to put private capital where it will go earn a reasonable return. And they raise this money from these either institutional or independent investors. Could be high net worth individuals or anybody like that. But so they get started that way. You know, the oldest funds date back to the 1960s, and there's new ones being created all the time. And frankly, as hedge funds have declined, I believe, in a large way in popularity, just because of the efficiency of public markets, there's been more and more money directed towards is private pools of capital or the private equity market. And when I say private equity, I mean both kind of traditional buyout funds for more mature businesses that have healthy, positive cash flows on the one hand. And on the other hand, I mean venture capital is a subsegment of private equity. And that might be for really, really high growth businesses like the next Uber of the world or whatever it might be.
Right, right. Absolutely. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And as far as the breakdown as to sizes, what would you consider to be a small private equity firm? And what are we talking about in terms of their capitalization rates when they start up? What would be the difference between a small, medium, large type firm so we can get an idea for how much money we're actually dealing with?
So I would say just kind of from my understanding, again, all this caveated being that this is sort of Brian Rassel's take on private equity and my interpretation. It may not really be the opinions of Huron Capital. I can only speak to myself as an individual, but to have a dedicated fund, and when I say dedicated fund, these are groups of people that other folks, other investors have made a promise and a pledge that is legally binding and written their name at the bottom that that dedicated fund, a small one might be $50 million. That'd be very small. Folks who are trying to invest less than that, generally speaking, have something more akin to a pledge fund. They have a number of people that they can pass the hat with to raise money on a deal-by-deal basis versus having committed capital to go invest in 5, 6, 10, 12 companies in that particular fund. So just kind of, you know, back of the envelope type math that you can think of, is every fund should have plus or minus roughly 10 investments to have enough diversification in it. So a $50 million fund is looking to put $5 million to work in the 10 different companies. And that would be the equity capital going to those companies. There's oftentimes a mix of equity and debt going into those companies. And we can talk about that later. And then, you know, a mid-sized fund might be $300 or $400 million and on up to the, you know, KKRs of the world or Apollo or the very big managers who are doing $15 billion funds. It's a whole different world. You know,
right.
They're taking Hilton Hotels private or something like that.
Right. I was going to say they're buying something completely different than your Amazon business.
Right? Yeah. That's right. That's a whole different world.
A whole different world. All right. You talked about you have successive funds. And my understanding, again, is that we go through these rounds of investment that are coming up. We had Andy Jones from privateequityinfo.com on, and he talked a lot about the holding periods that sure. Private equity looks for. Can you just, again, quickly touch on that? We're kind of doing private equity 101 here.
Yeah, I didn't hear Andy's remarks, but just as it relates to hold period, I would think of it just to be linear about it, that a private equity firm, once their capital is raised, so ignore the time that it takes to raise that money, and get the committed capital or even the pass the hat capital, they're going to take that money and let's just use this fictional $50 million fund, and they'll take something like 4 years to deploy the first 80% of it. And the goal would be to take 20% of that money and get it into new platform companies they had no money in before. In the first year, the next year, next 20%, next year, next 20%, next year, next 20%. So it's 80% deployed at that point. You can't do necessarily new investments. You're reserving that last 20% for either a company that's struggling that you need to give more money to keep it going, or to do an add-on investment to buy something else and add it on to something that's in the portfolio. So that might take 4 or 5 years just to really deploy the majority of it. And then another 4 to 5, you know, an investment from year one, ideally you're exiting that investment 3 to 7 years later, and let's just use 5 as a kind of round middle of the road number there. So an investment from year one is maybe gone in year 6 and it's being harvested. Could be sooner, could be later. And an investment that was your last platform investment from year 4 might be heading out the door in year 8 or 9. So a fund life is something like 8 to 10 years, can be longer. And in a traditional, as you kind of draw it up on a whiteboard like I have behind me here, is sort of a 5-year hold. Now I've seen many that are much, much shorter and many that are much, much longer. But those are the fat parts of the bell curve, if you will.
Sure. So is the goal of all private equity companies to grow and sell? So acquire, grow, sell? Or are there other strategies of buy and hold for long periods of time?
There are certainly evergreen funds out there. They're much more unique. When I say evergreen, they have the ability to hold and recycle the capital. They may be designed, I've heard of a number that that have committed capital from particularly family offices that never want to deal with the tax consequences of becoming liquid in an investment and actually realizing the gains. So they're structured to reinvest the money that they make, or if they sell something, to quickly find something else new for it to go into. But that would be a more unique situation. And then certainly family offices, there's a number out there that look for longer hold periods, and there's certain funds that are designed for a longer hold period.
All right, so this is going to be, again, another basic question, but want to make sure our terms are all well defined here. We hear these terms of platform versus bolt-on or add-on investments. Just real quick, the difference between a platform investment versus a bolt-on.
Yeah, I'll keep it simple, and I'll say anything that is a brand new business, new industry for that firm to go into, they don't currently own something in that space, whether that's a tiny initial acquisition or a big one, that would be the platform investment. So let's just say it was, internet brokered pencils. I'm just making this up, right? And they don't have any other investments in the internet brokered pencils space, and they invest in a company in that space. That would be the platform in that. And maybe there's 10 companies that do internet brokered pencils, and they buy two other ones of the competitors, and they make it bigger, or somebody does pens. Now they're putting it all together. Those might be add-ons to that original entity that they purchased or recapitalized. So that's what we mean. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with size, which can be confusing. Sometimes you start with something small and you get the opportunity to do an add-on that's much bigger than the original investment. So it's more just where's the starting point into a space or an industry.
Right. And if we think about the terms, it makes sense, right? You build on top of a platform and you add on top of a platform. So that makes that makes complete sense.
Or bolt on. Yep. That's where the nomenclature comes from. Yep.
Right. Or bolt on. Absolutely. It's amazing when you dig into definitions, it's like the terms actually have a meaning and it makes sense.
They do. They do. Generally, they come from somewhere.
They come from somewhere. There's logic to this stuff. I love it. I love it. All right. So now getting into questions that I'm starting to be genuinely interested in. And that is, how does a fund develop a thesis or an entire direction to go after a particular platform investment? I mean, if you're selling blue widgets and all of a sudden somebody comes in and says, no, you don't need widgets. What you really need are sprockets. Mm-hmm. And you don't do anything with sprockets at all. How does that enter into a fund's psyche at all?
There's really three things that we're doing here to generate the sort of deal flow and the ideas of spaces we want to go into. So here I'll speak more for Huron Capital. There's other firms who follow a similar philosophy potentially. So the first is businesses we didn't know about, but are being represented by a broker or an investment banker like yourself, Mark, who those are opportunities that are coming to us. They're being listed. They're being actively shopped around. We may have never thought of the sprocket industry before, or we didn't know too much about it, but we read materials on it. We say it has a lot of characteristics of things we like, you know, great cash flow, seems very resilient, seems counter-cyclical, that if the economy goes down, it'll still do well. It's, you know, a leader in its space, any of those kind of things. And those are opportunities that come to us. And that's more of a passive thing. And then we get active once we realize that it fits a lot of criteria and we believe we could be successful with it. And that sets into motion a whole chain of things where we kind of prove out the thesis that we might like this business and we try to get educated. The second that we spend a lot of time on is kind of networking with executives from a broad variety of industries. Those people know where there are spaces that are changing. And generally speaking, change creates opportunities. Change creates winners on the one side, losers on the other side, and bless be to the losers. But you know, you need that kind of disruption to create any sort of interesting investment outcome. The steady eddy is probably, the market's efficient enough that the steady eddy is not going to return the greatest returns. So we spend a lot of time with executives and listening to them about spaces that could be interesting and trying to listen to the areas they know about and start to build some theses around that. And then even more proactively than that, there's a lot of opportunities where we meet an executive who has a view of one particular thing they want to do. Here at Huron, it's a registered trademark or the like of the firm. We call that an exec factor investment, where we will actually flip the process and say, we really believe in the Sprocket industry. We met, you know, Phil, who is going to be our prospective CEO in the space, and he has this vision that is going to totally turn the industry on its head. And to do that, we need to go find a platform. We would call that like getting, you know, Phil behind the wheel. We need to find a car for Phil to drive. We believe he's the best driver in that industry. And we will do all the work. We'll go, we'll write a 100-page white paper on it to prove to our investment committee why this is such a fabulous opportunity and Phil's the greatest operator in the space. And then we will commit dollars to going and finding businesses in that space and find Phil the car he can drive. And we'll get off to the races that way. So it starts with a commitment from our fund for a certain amount of money behind Phil to go do an acquisition or more in the space. So it I guess ranges from that passive, we find things and then we get educated, to we educate ourselves as much as possible and align ourselves with an executive who can execute and work the process the other way.
Cool. All right. That's super helpful as well. So let's talk a little bit about the process that goes on behind the scenes when you're evaluating an opportunity. And I think for a lot of potential sellers, this sort of conversation is going to be really insightful, right? So
sure.
Let's say we have somebody that they have an e-com business, 30 million in revenue, you know, 8-9 million in earnings on an annual basis. And they've got a couple of private equity firms looking at their business. Where does that start? And then what is the process going through? And mm-hmm. we can talk about maybe Huron's process, and then if there's variations that you know as well, you know, the number of people that are going to look and touch that deal as it goes through the steps. What are some of those behind the scenes looks?
Yeah, so once you've got that moment where there's a couple of firms interested, there's going to be an incredible amount of information about the business across insurance, benefits, compliance with laws and regulatory statutes, information about the market, anything the business can possibly produce about itself, literally every kind of file that's off the shelf that they have, every non-disclosure agreement they have with somebody that they onboarded, or employment agreement, every contract they have with a customer, or maybe, you know, it's an industry where you don't have a lot of contracts with customers, but you have a lot of contracts with suppliers. All of that information needs to be made available for these prospective buyers to digest. And the more that can be made available, the more that's organized into different buckets of legal, employee, insurance, benefits, blah, 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 the better. It's going to save the company a lot of time from serving requests versus being proactive by getting that stuff out there. And you don't really have anything to fear. All the buyers be under a non-disclosure agreement. And that's just a very kind of well-oiled machine around making that information available to get your last few buyers down to the one you would like to choose and have them under a letter of intent. And that starts to be an exclusive relationship where the buyer is going to spend a lot of money on due diligence. And in exchange for spending that money, they would like the exclusive right to purchase the business for a period of time, 60 days, 90 days, while they engage. And here's where it starts to get be a lot more kind of in your trousers and really analyzing your business. But they're going to engage quality of earnings firm to go and understand, you know, did you actually produce the amount of revenue? Have you booked it in the right time periods? Have you really accounted for every cost, et cetera? They're going to engage legal professionals who are going to first do sort of just, again, a full workup of registration compliance with applicable law. And then those folks are going to work on the actual transaction documents, as well as a host of other advisors. And that would be like, again, a 60 to 90 day process. Could be 30 days on the short end. There's firms who can do it in that time, particularly if you're a smaller business and an add-on for a much larger or a very simple business.
So how many people are we talking about there that are going to be involved in that process? Outside of the consultants, like a QOV, a quality of earnings report, that's going to be an outside accounting firm, right? So we're talking.
Okay, so from the acquiring firm.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we can start at the beginning. We can start at your interns that are digesting deals, right? That's going to be sure. Point one.
Yeah, call it four, and they're going to be answering to the remainder of their firm, particularly their investment committee. But, you know, ideally it's a tighter team and there's four. And if it's an add-on, expect more. So you'll have the management team of the kind of platform investment as well. So 4 to 8. And then when you get to the advisor level, you're talking 20 some more.
Right, right. Getting all those outside advisors. Now, one of the things I know people get worried about during this process is you start out again with that guy who's vetting deals up front, and he sees some, he passes it on to the team, and they end up liking it. So now you're dealing with a handful of people that are asking the questions, digging deep in that due diligence, right? Pages and pages of collecting information, mm-hmm. possibly even submitting an offer because on the surface things look okay.
Yep.
There seems to be this back end in investors committee as well, which can also kind of kibosh the deal far in the process. What would you say to people that get kind of frustrated when they hear that and they think, wow, do I really want to work with a private equity? Because there's so many people that could potentially disrupt this deal.
So I would think about the time investment two ways. So the private equity firm is in no way interested in wasting any of their time. You know, Huron looks at something like little or 1,000 deals a year. That takes a lot of time, and we're very thoughtful about moving things through the funnel and committing our firm's resources to evaluating an opportunity. So if somebody's spending the time, I would tell the listeners that they are encouraged. If everything checks out the way that it's been told to them so far, or they've read so far about that business, then there's absolutely no issues. The firm, an organized and real firm, is going to be thoughtful and time's their kind of most valuable resource, and they are set up to be able to make a number of stage gates, kind of, we're interested, we're not interested. We're interested subject to confirmation of 1, 2, and 3. And you can have it a very quick conversation like you and I are having now to say, is this the case? Is this not the case? Here's a big concern we have. Should we be worried? And they will both take your answer, and that gives them the kind of gumption to proceed, and they'll probably have to go validate that as well later. And that validation just has to support what's been told to them. But they're also making a big commitment of their time in the same way that the seller is. And I would take it as genuine on their part that they're not looking for it to fall apart. It's just things do. Certain deals fall apart because new information becomes available. I've seen it happen a number of times where the seller learns things about their business or thinks about their business in a way they hadn't before and can agree that that's a genuine risk and maybe something they want to work on over the course of another year, and then they might be back to market.
Yeah, no, that happens often. We see that all the time. Even in the amount of work that we put a seller through up front pales in comparison to what you guys are going to be doing in your actual like dig deep due diligence. And the number of times that we have people come back and tell us that was a lot of work, but that was really useful. Like I learned a lot about my own business, right?
Yeah, a great advisor, like somebody like you and using a broker who's been through it and understands the questions that are going to be asked, is going to save a tremendous amount of time. We call folks like you, Mark, a river guide. We use them on our side, and we love when sellers use them too, because they're that much more prepared for the process.
Yeah. And I can tell you, like, the one thing that I'm going to play both sides here. I would say the one thing that can be difficult with working with private equity is because there are so many people that can come in with a dissenting viewpoint. You're not trying to convince is a bad word, but show the opportunity to one person and have them agree to it. You're having to show a number of people. But the great thing, and I love working with private equity on, is that it's completely unemotional throughout the process. I mean, it really is, does this check the boxes we need to check? And if it doesn't, you know, we're going to find out as quick as we can. You said something, I was going to ask you this question. Do you guys evaluate, you said about 1,000 deals per year?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, the pipeline, I mean, if you think of it's working its way down at the top of the funnel, that's over 1,000, and then that's working its way down to 250 that real solid time is being spent on, and then kind of 75 that we're spending real tons of resources and traveling around to visit them, or maybe 80. You know, I'll get these numbers wrong. This is kind of directional. And then down to the 30 or so that are getting a lot of attention, and we'll close 20 few transactions a year.
Yeah. So that's an amazing amount of data to be pulling in. And you guys have criteria at every stage, I assume, right? That you're looking up front. Okay. All right. That makes sense. Do you publish that criteria? I know we get a lot of just the very broad stuff sent to us.
We don't, only because it's just so bespoke for every company. You know, There's so many things that really are, as you just said, that are check the box, and we're highly confident that we will go confirm later. But we're highly confident that's not an issue. And we are trying to get to very, very quickly the three or four things we want to make sure are the reasons we're most excited and confirm that that is factual and that is going to continue, whatever that might be, around the customer relationship or the recurring purchasing or whatever it might be. And then at the same time, the three or four things that are kind of, we're concerned that could be deal killers. We believe we're spending the time because we think that's not going to turn out to be true, but we need to get to a yes, no about, is this a real problem, very, very quickly. And so, you know, it's just, they're different for every business.
Yeah. Yeah. I know a lot of the people listening right now, you guys are buyers. You're out there looking to acquire. So technically, Brian, you guys are somewhat of competitors, although I think that you operate at a range that a lot of our buyers wouldn't. But I think one thing interesting that they should hear is this idea of having this defined process, number one, and then number two, the amount of deal flow that you have to look at. I've talked to buyers that have been out there looking for a year, year and a half, but then you find out the number of deals that they're actually looking at doesn't really, this is a numbers game. I mean, it's purely a numbers game.
It is. And one thing I want to say on that numbers game for us, and it may be different for some of your buyers or not, is that we're looking for situations that are great for us. And we're also looking for situations where the seller in some way is choosing us. Now, I don't want to overstate that, but I do want to say that there has to be great fit and a reason why we're a better owner than someone else for that business. You know, some angle that we have, some affinity we have for what they do or some prior experience or something. Otherwise, and that can be a little bit different for particularly your smaller businesses. Maybe it's a little bit less like them. It doesn't need as much of the chemistry. But that's a big part of what we're looking for sure.
Now, we talk about that a lot on this podcast. I know you guys are probably tired of hearing Joe and I talk about the need for a buyer being a good fit. And we talked a lot about just this general concept of being likable. Mm-hmm. Because sellers do eventually choose. And for most of these sellers, they do have a choice. I mean, right now it's a seller's market. They do have a choice on who they're going to work with. I want to talk about the exciting stuff. Let's talk about the actual deals, the money.
Sure.
Why is selling to a private equity something that people should be excited about?
I think, you know, I spoke a little bit about this at Rhodium, but I see that the difference in multiples that are paid for businesses that aren't exclusively e-commerce or SaaS-based businesses, that those multiples are so much lower than what private equity firms are paying for more traditional businesses out in the economy. And I believe that those worlds will come together. And I believe that businesses that are a hybrid of both or have excellence in both and a foot in both worlds are going to be extremely, extremely valuable. Because on the one hand, they have the relevance for the future, what is coming from kind of the types of businesses that you represent. And also they have that anchor of the traditional business that makes them more underwritable and makes them more predictable because it's a less dynamic place that they're out in. And so that's where, I think private equity firms in the coming 2, 3, 4, 5 years are, number one, going to become much more comfortable with standalone e-commerce business models that are exclusively that. And there's going to be people participating from the much more kind of like formal private equity world participating in your markets. And then I think there's going to be a convergence where a lot of more traditional business models are going to look for the influence and the DNA, as well as the revenue and the profits, but the influence and the DNA and the growth that comes from the types of businesses you represent. And I think that means that the market that you're playing in, the multiples will rise there. You know, for every dollar of earnings, they'll be more valuable in the future. And I believe that's borne out in a very significant way in 2018.
Yeah, we talk about this, this idea of multiple appreciation that we see. And a lot of it we attribute to the fact that this is where private equity starts to play, right? So we often talk, you know, if your EBITDA is less than $1 million per year, you know, the just again, for the sake of a multiple, it's going to vary for each business, but maybe, maybe 3.5 would be the multiple on that EBITDA, depending on the type of business that you have. But once you start getting up into $2, 3, 4 million of EBITDA, now we start seeing the multiples jump up into different ranges. And the reason for this, again, is that we're no longer playing as much with an individual investor who really has a much higher risk profile because they don't necessarily have the entire team behind them or a portfolio behind them to be able to mitigate some of that risk. But also, again, that staff in the background, right, and all the resources in private equity. So let's talk. I'm not going to pin you down because it would be really bad idea for you to say, hey, we generally pay 25x on earnings, which I know you don't. What does a deal structure often look like? Because I know these deal structures do change as well when we're talking about a private equity acquiring a small company. What does an ideal acquisition look like for you in terms of a structure of cash that the owner is going to be getting, maybe equity or debt that you would hope that they stay around? And I'd also like to address the idea that a lot of private equity likes to have or prefers to have an owner stay on board with a new company and why that's a good thing also for that owner to think about that. So that's a lot. Let's talk general structure, the ideal sort of structure.
Okay, so let's keep this out of your space and let's just talk about the general PE model, right? When deals were cheaper a couple of years ago, you might have a higher ratio of debt than equity in a deal. But for this sake, I'm just going to make it 50-50. I think that more reflects the market today in terms of underwriting. But let's take a deal where a private equity firm is paying, I'll use 8x. That's still a relatively rich multiple. I could have said 6, but let's use 8x. So they're paying 4x the earnings in their own cash out of their pocket, and they are going, putting the company on the hook or raising 4x, and they do it. The private equity firm does it, but on behalf of the company, of debt for the business to take on. So let's say it's a business with $10 million of EBITDA. So an $80 million transaction, and a firm like Huron's putting in $40 million of equity and raising $40 million of debt. In that transaction, and that $40 million of equity can come either from Huron or some portion of it could be rollover from the seller. The debt seller has no debt on the business today, no capital leases or anything else that could be thought of as indebtedness other than normal trade payables, kind of your day-to-day, you got cash coming in, cash going out type thing that keep the shop running. If they have no debt on the business, theoretically, on the day of closing, they're getting a check for $80 million. Should they choose to roll over some of that, let's just say 10% of the purchase price, $8 million of it, I would argue that a private equity firm or somebody like me would take that as them stating a high degree of confidence in the future of the business, that they want to continue to participate and have a relatively meaningful portion of their net worth tied up in that outcome. Or that they see the opportunity to turn that $8 million into $16 or whatever it might be, you know, that there is a great opportunity to continue driving growth in equity value in that business. So I'll start there, that I think rollover investments are very useful because if you're saying you want to do no rollover whatsoever and you just want to walk away from the business, it's not conveying a lot of confidence in the future of the business. There's certainly reasons to do that, but it's not conveying a lot of confidence in the future of the business, and where somebody might have been willing to pay you $8 if you were rolling over and giving that kind of, you know, tacit support for the business going over, they might kind of say, yeah, this is, we're not so sure. It makes them a little more nervous, and it might be a 7x deal. So you may actually be shooting yourself in the foot in terms of the total proceeds you receive. But so again, so it's an $80 million deal, $40 million of debt. Sellers choosing to roll over. They got their $80 million check. It doesn't work like this. You actually net it out, but they got their $80 million check and they immediately wrote one back for $8 million. And so Huron holds $32 million of the equity and that seller holds $8 million of it. So Huron owns 80% of the business and they own 20%. And we've got some obligation to the bank. That would be kind of a middle of the road structure. There's certainly a lot more that happens as it relates to creating incentive for management teams. And that's a very, very big part of what we do to make sure that if we do well, they do well and vice versa. So that we're all talking in terms of growing the underlying equity value of the business. And that can often be very different for a business that didn't have that before. And it was just solely kind of the founder driving it or minding the growth of equity value. We believe in creating a broad base of ownership so that we're all on the same page.
Yeah.
Our management team isn't incented exclusively through their salary or bonus or both.
Right, right. So one of the things that I've talked about a lot in the past, especially on like Main Street sort of deals, is this almost dichotomy, and it really shouldn't be set up as a dichotomy, of a marketplace-based sale where you only have an investor looking to acquire a business, and a strategic sale where you have a company that it would effectively be like an add-on acquisition in your world, right? They already have that sort of strategic advantage to acquiring that company. Within your world, it seems like so much of what you do is going to be this strategy-based type of acquisition anyway.
That's right.
Like, you're not going to do an acquisition unless you think that you have a strategic advantage. And when you and I talked out in Las Vegas back at last October, you know, one thing that you talked about quite a bit was we want to pour gasoline on the fire that's already existing.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So wherever that might be. And so as a seller who's out there thinking about this is saying, man, you know, I've been growing my business like crazy, but I'm investing all this cash back into acquiring more inventory and expanding the product line. And I'd like to take money off the table and then keep growing it.
Mm-hmm.
This is that perfect sort of handoff to a private equity, right? Because you can say, you know what? You have been pouring, you know, your income statement rich and cash flow poor, right? Yeah. We got cash. We'll help you out there. You're going to get some cash on the table. And then let's grow this from a $30 million business to a $100 million business.
Right.
And so there's incentive there for that owner to double dip, as it were.
Absolutely. Particularly in situations, we see this all the time, where additional capital is going to be an accelerant to growth. So capital is what we have, and we're trying to find a smart place to put it to work. And if that means we can buy a business and continue to support that business with more dollars, and we believe in the strategy and what's going on and the way it's being operated, there's nothing that's the easiest dollar for us to put out versus the whole re-underwriting process of a new investment. And then for that seller to have all their eggs in one basket, you know, I don't care what their life situation is. They could be in their 30s and just want to diversify, or they could be somebody who's looking at kids who are about to go to college, and you know, it just doesn't make sense to have 100% of their net worth or close to it tied up in their business. And if they could diversify a little bit or generate a little bit of cash, but their vision hasn't changed at all, that's a great situation to bring on a strategic partner, like a private equity firm. And that's where that, going back to that fit, it really matters, and the chemistry between seller. And for the most part, you're not going to sell to a private equity firm. They don't want to be in business. Well, we're definitely not in the business of operating companies. So we're in the business of investing in them, helping bring the right resources to them, bring them the right capital solutions or capital availability, all that, helping them set strategy and all the other things, but the actual day-to-day operations. So it's not going to be for your sellers or buyers, really sellers, who are looking to exit the business and hand it off to somebody else. Private equity is not going to be the right solution. But for those companies that they either want to go be a division of something larger, and they think they could be a great, you know, cross-selling opportunity, or the way they've built their mousetrap, if just they had more to sell in the same way. And I'll say, like, let's say you're the number one muffler seller online, and you also want to do transmissions and drive cams and stuff, but you don't have the capital and you don't have the ability to go source and expand that way. Going and selling to a larger entity and being that e-commerce division is a very powerful idea. Or just continuing to do your own business and double down, accelerate the organic growth, private equity firm can be a great partner.
Yeah, we're just about out of time. In fact, we've gone a little bit long, but one thing I wanted to emphasize here, you said that capital obviously is the resource you guys have and are able to invest. And I know a lot of people that I talk to say, look, you know, I don't really need money from this. The business is making money and I feel good about this. But what I find when I actually start to dig in with these guys is I say, well, what would it take to move to that next level? Oh, well, I would have to hire out this other division or create this other division. And, you know, and okay, well, what's the obstacle to that? I don't want to invest in it, right? Yeah. And it often comes, okay, that's an area where a firm like yours can also come in and say, well, look, we have the capital to be able to invest in this. You know what you need. Do you want to invest in it to get to that next stage? And even if that means bringing in someone and you can help with that, let's do it. Exactly. We can do that. And we can.
Not to mention, I think we find that often business owners are willing to do one out of their five ideas that are like that. And we're willing to do all five, knowing that three won't work, but two should work out beautifully. And we're willing to go help bring the bodies to the business and the capital and have the appetite to take, you know, two steps backward to take four forward and understand that they're not going to all work. And where maybe an independent owner would do those sequentially, try idea one, wasn't really working, didn't feel pleased with making that investment, losing that cash flow, you know, fired that new salesperson who was supposed to do something else. We're willing to go do things faster and make sure that that doesn't overwhelm the business in the core of what we are interested in the first place. And so we'll work through that with the business owner, but give them that support and the dollars needed to make that happen.
Now, Brian, I really appreciate you taking the time here, humoring me with some of the small questions I had, but really good to get those things defined. So thanks again, and maybe we'll have you back again in the future at some point.
That sounds great. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.